Support for KMUW's Into Music podcast comes from McClelland, reminding listeners that Frank Sinatra coined the word skibbity in Strangers in the Night, which you can listen to in their downtown Wichita showroom. More info on McClelland's innovative sound, lighting, and video technology can be found at maxsound.com.
Hi, I'm Jed Bodwin, and you're listening to Into Music from the KMUW studios, part of the NPR Podcast Network. My guest on this episode is David Jay. David Jay's latest release is Tracks from the Attic Revisited and follows his triple 2024 archival record, Tracks from the Attic, which featured songs from over four decades of writing and recording. The ever-prolific artist felt compelled to work on several of the songs again, rewriting lyrics and contemplating sounds that would move the material into the present, no matter when the songs were conceived. He recently spoke about this new collection, the players he assembled for the recording, and snake hunting with the late William S. Burroughs. That's David Jay on Into Music, coming up now. So happy to be talking to you about this new album. It's kind of fascinating to me that this has its origins in material that, you know, kind of got left aside and so forth. Tell me about that process when you decided to kind of revisit it further for this record.
Well, it was suggested to me by the label, by Independent Project Records, and I immediately went for it because in the process of when I initially assessed those old demos, in the process of listening to them for the first time, quite often in decades, you know, I was getting ideas about where I could have taken this song and what I could have done with this particular piece. And just naturally, you know, it's just like I put my producer hat on without really having any intention of following through on that. But I had ideas already bouncing around. So when that idea came up, I was totally up for it and kind of raring to go. And I'd already, again, in that process initially, like evaluating what I had with the demos, I'd made kind of selections of, like, I cherry-picked, like, in the back of my head and placed those on a real back burner, never thinking that I'd make anything from them, but there I ended up in the kitchen cooking up the medicine.
Now, I mean, there's lots of reasons, right, that songs maybe don't make a record or they don't get past the demo stage. And I'm imagining that oftentimes it isn't that you don't feel like the song is good, but that it's just not ready in some way, or it's just not going to fit with other things that you're working on at the time, right?
Yeah, sometimes that's the case. I mean, some of those demos, the original demos that were on the first selection, the Tracks in the Attic, the three album set, they're real sketches, you know, they're just little notes and they're fragments, really. But there are others that are fully formed songs, and they really only fell by the wayside because I do tend to be quite prolific, you know, and other songs come up all the time. And really it's a matter of timing in some regards, because it's the one that's like most, the newest one is the most present in my consciousness. So if I'm in, I've got a studio session booked, It's those newer songs that are going to take precedence, and they're going to come to the fore, and those are the ones I'm going to pursue. And the ones that have come up a bit earlier tend to sort of fall by the wayside. So it's all part, you know, all of those reasons come into play.
So with this collection, I love that there are the references to the now, you know, the ideas of tech bros and, you know, for instance, on I Wish Those Spacemen Would Come, and a kind of capturing of this moment in time that runs, you know, not necessarily through every song, but it is, they are unified in that way as a kind of reflection of this moment.
Yeah, well, obviously I rewrote those lyrics because those original songs were written in the 80s and 90s, most of them. And so I tweak the lyrics here and there to make them more current. Yeah. and I had a bit of fun doing that. Yeah, for sure. But others are not. They're outside of a timeline. Most of them are, you know. They're not pertinent to the time that they were written. They're larger than that. But yeah, there are a few of those references.
And I have to say that I appreciate that they're done with humor injected in them as well. It's not all just like, oh my God, the apocalypse is nigh.
No, well, I think it was John Lennon made a point once about writing, topical lyrics and lyrics that carry some sort of social commentary. That if you're going to make a statement, it's made more palatable and in some regards more powerful if you inject a bit of humor in there.
Yeah. I don't know about you.
Satire is a powerful weapon.
Yes.
Well, I think about that too, with that idea of science fiction and how often I think I talk to young people and sometimes they miss that science fiction is really often commentary on contemporary issues, you know?
Oh yeah. Probably the best science fiction is, and that which sort of relates in general to the human condition. But it's just put into the context of a futuristic sci-fi scenario. And sometimes that can be, it's just a metaphor, as you're suggesting here, for like what's going on now, here and now.
Yeah. Were you influenced by science fiction, like growing up?
Oh yeah, huge into that. Absolutely. I love science fiction from like my early teens. Very much into writers like, I don't know, Theodore Sturgeon, Ray Bradbury. I love Ray Bradbury in particular. Asimov, to a degree, Moorcock. I kind of devoured all of that. Yeah, very much so. And then going back to H.G. Wells, and Victor Hugo, way back.
Wonder if I have this sense that maybe living in England after the world wars and everything, that there was a lot that was being reflected in science fiction that was sometimes specific to that culture, to the world after the war and living in the aftermath of that.
Yeah, and particularly in the presence of the Cold War, and the threat of imminent nuclear annihilation. And that was very to the fore, certainly in the 80s. I used to have a lot of nightmares about a nuclear apocalypse, and then those abated for quite a while, and now I notice that they have returned. Those nightmares, and even with more frequency these days. It's just a very vivid kind of subconscious, imagining you are in a situation and the nuclear bomb has been dropped, and just the light that comes from that. And it's always silent in these films, but it's terrifying. So yeah, that's been reoccurring of late. I wonder why.
I'm old enough to remember when you would see those fallout shelter signs on buildings, I know, like the grocery store up the street from where I grew up. That was where we were supposed to go in case of a nuclear attack, as though.
Yeah, we didn't have that in England, but we had, at school they would give us some like drills, get under your desk and like that's gonna help. Get under your desk and close your eyes real tight.
Yeah.
But when they would show us films as well, which were terrifying, anti-war films, were pro-nuclear disarmament movies, that also terrified the bejeebus out of us little kids.
So I guess, one way of I don't know, alleviating that anxiety, as I was saying earlier, is through through song and through the creation of art. As you're, you know, making music, do you have a sense of that, of like, you know, maybe this isn't going out and marching with a sign, but maybe this is in some way alleviating some things?
Well, the song becomes the sign, doesn't it? And that is a particular sign that can be held very high and seen by a lot of people, you know, even more so than an actual physical sign, although that's important to go out and do that.
Yeah.
We need more and more of that these days.
You also touch, I think, a little bit on, especially on New Year's Day, at least the way that I heard the song was the process of aging, of time passing, and what things are we going to embrace as we get older, as we have less time and have to be more focused with our decisions.
Yeah, and I wrote that like 30 years ago. So now that's even more present.
Yeah.
Although it's really the main thrust of that song is more global. It's cynical, you know, it is against satirical and world weary. And realistic, I think, you know. And again, a lot of humor in that one, but it's pretty black humor. And again, I made one of those topical changes to the lyrics, because the original one had a reference to Patrick Walker. I don't know if you're familiar with him, but he was an astrologer back in the 60s and 70s and 80s. He was very famous in England. He was the man, you know, Patrick Walker, and he'd had his daily horoscope. And so originally I had, you know, what, pass the paper, what does Patrick Walker say? Patrick Walker and his well-informed friends have run away, which I changed to Lisa Stardust, as she's sort of the current famous, you know, astrologer. And the paper became the smartphone. So it's pass the smartphone, what does Lisa Stardust say? So that's a good example of that, you know, lyric tweaking to make it contemporary.
Tell me a little bit about the band that you assembled for this album.
Yeah, I've been playing with most of those guys for a very long time. They're kind of like my personal wrecking crew. And I'm very pleased, you know, that they are at hand. They're brilliant players, every one of them. David Raven, drummer. He's a top session guy that he's played with everybody, from Keith Richards to, I don't know, Lucinda Williams, Steve Earle. I think he played with Iggy at one point. He has his own band, the Mojo Monkeys, who are great. They do a residency at this Irish pub here in LA, and they have different guests come in and some quite big names drop in to play with them. I've played with them a few times and sang with them. And then on the bass is Tony Green. He was an excellent, he's a double bassist as well as a bass guitarist. And he plays a lot of jazz. And he's really schooled in that, you know. So he certainly knows what he's doing. And he's the guy who runs the studio, Ear Gallery Music in LA, which I've been using for, God, getting on for 20 years now. And he's a really good engineer. And we are super simpatico in the studio. You know, we have a rapport that's it's almost telepathic now. You know, anyway, he's the bass player, and then the on the keys, piano, organ, etc., is John Bernstein, and he's wonderful. I've been playing with him for about 7 years now, and again, classically schooled. He knows what he's doing. And the guitar player is the most recent recruit, and that's Jason Brown, who's just so tasteful and a great guy. He plays with Spoon. He's the lead guitarist in Spoon. And I discovered him when I went to see Marc Maron, who's probably my favorite comedian, do his thing here at Largo in LA. And he was doing this particular night. I didn't know he was going to do this. I thought he was just going to do his stand-up thing, but he was doing a bit of that. but it was mainly music. And he had a band because Mark plays guitar. And so the guitarist just blew me away. And that was Jason. So I met Jason through that gig and basically poached him. I ran into Maren in a record store, Gimme Gimme Records, which is one of my favorite stores here, and had a laugh about that. I've nicked your guitar player, you know. Although I think he still plays with Mark, although he's very, very busy with Spoon these days. But that's the basic band. And then occasionally, on some of the tracks, there's an odd, guy who came in just to play on that song, like Stephen Perkins plays conga drums on one of the tracks. There's a guy, Smokey, who plays accordion. I met Smokey at Smokey Roberts. I met him at a house party that David Raven, the drummer, held, and he has these regular get-togethers. He lives in this old, it's a lovely house. It's a big sort of rambling. It's like a vicarage, we would say in England, a rectory, and covered with ivy and overgrown with that. And he has a big room in the middle of the house where all the musicians gather, and we just sort of take it in turns and sing and play songs. And I took it upon myself to play Bob Dylan's "Knocking on Heaven's Door," and this guy was there with his accordion. He started playing along, and it was really magic. And I wanted to record it, so I booked a session like the next day to go in with him. And then it turns out that Smokey plays accordion with Bob Dylan. I didn't know that. Of course he's gonna have that song down. He's actually really good friends with Dylan in his house sat, and in Woodstock, and quite a character, yeah. So that's the band, basically.
Yeah. Well, I love that idea of
So, sorry, it's Robert. It's Smokey Miles, not Roberts. Robert Smokey Miles.
Okay.
And I had met him once before. He opened for me because he does this thing called Count Smokula, where he dresses up like a vampire. And plays the accordion and plays polkas. It's really bizarre. He actually opened for me, he reminded me, like years and years ago. He was booked by the promoter, and I do remember him. There's a funny story there because I actually threw him out of the dressing room because he was his presence was unwanted by this woman I had performing with me, who was disrobing. And I don't know if it might have been a bit of paranoia on her part, but she thought Smokey was taking a bit too much of a furtive interest in what was going on. So I frog marched him out of the studio. I reminded him of that, and he said, no, she got the wrong end of the stick.
Well, I love that idea of when there's a group of people just gathered in a room playing music, and it's sometimes you don't know the other players, like you're
No,
just.
no. No, that's really wonderful. And what an ancient tradition, around the campfire, going way back.
Yeah.
Cool.
I think that too is something we need more of in the world.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. It's sort of the opposite to being stuck in front of a screen
Yeah.
and a remote, it's not a remote.
It's powerful.
So you mentioned, being prolific, and I would imagine that on some level maybe you're already thinking about kind of the next thing or continuing to write. Is that true?
Yeah, I mean, I have a completed double album that's going to be coming out in the autumn. That's a very ambitious, my most ambitious album ever done, in that it has a lot of strings on it. It has on one track, it has a 23-piece orchestra that I recorded in Prague, and a lot of the tracks have strings, and but some of the tracks are very simple, and some of the players that played on the new record, the revisited record, like Jason Brown, are on that record. And I'm quite excited about that one when it comes out. And I want to be doing some dates to promote that. But this past couple of weeks, I've been writing new songs. I've had a spurt of creativity, and I've been recording them as they've been coming up with Tony in the studio again. I'm working on one right at this moment. I've got it here. Actually, I'm working on three. So, but it's not like that all the time. I mean, I have dry spells, and it's fine. It's almost like a relief. And because I never try to write, it just comes, with some urgency.
I'm familiar, although I write prose primarily. I might be in the living room listening to music or something, and all of a sudden there's a couple of ideas that have just.
Well, I went to the shops just now before I just made it home in time to get to you. It's quite hot outside, but I was just walking, and this melody came to me, and then some lyrics, which is unusual because usually it's the other way around. Lyrics come and then the melody, but a very arresting melody just popped into my head, and I had time to record it on my phone before I connected with you, so it's ongoing.
Do you mind if I ask one Bauhaus question?
I don't know.
I was listening to Mask recently, and I really love the way that you and your brother and Daniel play off of each other and make space. And I was thinking it was almost like a dance, the way that you would communicate with each other, you know? Like, here's this, I'm going to pass it to you. What do you bring back to me? Was that how you functioned, kind of?
Yeah, and it's kind of unspoken. It's just a matter of really listening and being receptive. I mean, you do speak about it eventually, but initially the conversation is purely musical, and then when something is it's gelling, then there's a moment where you make a point of recognizing that, hey, that was good. Well, let's do that again. And so you sort of capture that butterfly in the net, and then try and get it, down on tape as soon as possible. While it's still vital sounding.
And I would just say that I think that carries over in the music that we're hearing on this album, and that everybody has their space, and there's this respect of what everybody's doing. Nobody's, overplaying or anything.
Yeah, so I sent those original demos to the band, but I also worked up new versions just on my own, just on the acoustic guitar, and then sent those, just recorded on my phone, and then sent those to the band, and with the minimal notes, like what the mood is, and to him, like come in with a solo here, and but I leave quite a lot of it up to their own interpretation, because that's where that way I think the music is alive, and the player brings their own persona to it. And that's really important. I don't like dictate. Not in fact, I'm not. I wouldn't be that capable of, saying you play all this note and that note. Well, I could, but it wouldn't be as good. Anyway, by the time we got into the studio, we all came in together, and we would just lay those tracks down, all playing at the same time. I'd be playing like a guy rhythm and a scratch vocal in the same room with them, and we'd isolate instruments to a great degree, but I quite like a little bit of bleed. I think that is nice, like the old school, the drummer's mic picking up a bit of the guitarist's sound, it makes for the glue. But we would get those tracks down in either the first or second take, the basic track, and then I would do minimal overdubs, usually just me and Jason, guitar player, and then the vocals, layer in some harmonies, and then it's all down to mixing, and then And then mastering, which is really important. There you go. Very pretty direct, straightforward process.
Before I go, I have to ask, being living in Kansas as I do, I believe you visited William Burroughs in Lawrence at least
Yeah,
once. What
1989. Yeah.
yeah. What did you kind of make of him in that setting?
I think he was very contented in there, in that little bungalow. It was very neat and tidy. Everything was in its place. And that's the thing with him. I mean, I think he was very organized, kind of disciplined. And I remember he was writing as well. I found out later he was writing The Cat Inside. And he had all these cats. So he had like seven cats all over him. And I saw a very soft side of him as when he was sort of puckering his lips and blowing little kisses to all of them. And, well, I'm beautiful, all my little babies. Smoking a joint and writing in this book. And then occasionally, and it was a weird situation because I didn't want to interfere with his creative process. Although I was there all afternoon and some of the night. But occasionally he'd put the book aside and then we'd talk about stuff. Or he would go in the back room and bring something out to show me. But he kept looking at his watch, and on the stroke of 5 o'clock, I believe it was. That was it. It was vodka time. And we ended up going on a walk. He asked me if I'd ever been on a snake hunt. And I said, "No, Bill, I have not done that." I said, "Well, come on." And he showed me his snake stick, which was this stick like with a forked prong on it to catch snakes. And I had a big tumbler of vodka and coke, and he had the same. And we went in the garden, big backyard, looking for snakes. And I remember thinking how surreal this was. I was looking at the back of his bald head, in the sunlight, and with his snake skin in his stick and his vodka and my vodka, and thinking this is just too surreal. And we didn't find any snakes. The reason he was catching the snakes was that there were some poisonous ones out there, and they would get the cats, So we'd catch them, and he had these cages at the back, and he put them in cages, and then take them to the forest and release them. And I asked him, I said, do you ever kill them? He was alarmed. He said, "No, beautiful creatures, I've never hurt a snake." Yeah, no, that was quite an experience.
You've been listening to a conversation with David Jay. His new album, Tracks from the Attic Revisited, is out now via Independent Project Records and may be ordered at davidjayofficial.bandcamp.com. You can learn more about him overall at davidjhaskins.com. You can learn more about this podcast and all programming on our station by visiting our website, kmuw.org. Send us your questions and comments at info@kmuw.org and find all the latest programming notes on that website as well. Thanks again for listening. We'll see you next time, and as always, we'd like to remind you that our theme music is composed and performed by Torin Anderson.